Hi, and welcome to the Investors First Podcast, a service of CFA Society Orlando. Each episode features a local subject matter expert from our society to chat with the nation's leading experts on financial topics and investors' mistakes in order to make you a savvy and smart investor, less likely to fall victim to all the common mistakes people make with their money. Learn more about the CFA Society Orlando and subscribe to the Investors First Podcast at cfasociety.org/Orlando/podcast. Welcome back to the Investors First Podcast. If you're listening to this and didn't listen to part one of our episode with Barry Ritholtz, please do me a favor, pause this, go back and listen to that part now. If you enjoyed the first part, I'm sure you're going to love this. So without further ado, let's just jump right back into it.
Pivoting to your day job, one of multiple day jobs, manager selection. I know in the past you've talked about how you've emphasized more passive on equities, but on fixed income, you prefer active as the statistics are more in favor for active managers on the fixed income side.
So bonds are easy. The math of the stock market is there's the Wilshire 5000 has 3,400 stocks in it. It's kind of funny. It's supposed to be 5,000. But even at 5,000, there's only so many stocks to choose from. Eliminate the micro caps, eliminate the penny stocks. You're really talking about the S&P 500, the mid cap 600, the small cap 400. You don't even have to get to the back end of the Russell 2000. And there aren't a whole lot of choices there. And so a passive index ends up, the math is you end up dramatically outperforming the vast majority of active managers. Virtually all of them over a decade net of fees with a handful of outliers. You could take the Jim Simons and the Howard Marks and the Ray Dalios and go down the list, but they're outliers. The fact that you know their names means it's not 40% of the active community. Bond managers, on the other hand, have to sift through tens of thousands of issuances. Look at the muni bond market. It's like every separate issuance is bespoke, is almost a one-off. And so it's not so much a bond selection process as it is a credit duration and risk elimination process where bond managers add a lot of value by just keeping the real garbage out of your portfolio. And what I mean by garbage is, look, return is a function of risk. And so you want to make sure you are being adequately compensated for the risk you take. And so if you're going to get some general obligation bonds that yields 3% tax-free, but it's a really risky bond, well, that doesn't seem like a good deal to me. On the other hand, you can find high-quality general obligation bonds, high-quality municipal bonds that are tagged to a throughway, a dormitory, a something, and they're probably all not doing well this quarter. But by and large, they've done well historically, and they compensate the investors with a higher quality risk and a better yield than others. So letting bond managers make those credit and risk determinations, that's shown to generate alpha on the fixed income side. If there wasn't tens of thousands of random bonds out there, it might be a different situation. But now, today, and for the past 30, 40 years, it really seems that bond managers are capable of generating returns in excess of fees where stock managers have a much more difficult time with that.
Yeah, and I've always thought that bond managers should be paid more than equity managers. It's inverted because of the expected returns are so much lower. But
that's right.
And then pivoting to a previous podcast that I heard you on, Trillions, and talking about how you started to follow different writers, commentators, podcast hosts, and you found that certain writers were right more often. And you said, hey, I'm going to follow that person. Can you speak to your process for finding good writers? Because some of our listeners are starting from scratch and curating is going to be the future. There's so much information out there. And who do we rely on to curate information?
So let me give a plug to the Daily Reads, which is at ritholtz.com. You could sign up for those 7 days a week. It's a list of 10 things that are interesting and worth pursuing. And that's a pretty broad net of writers. The core group of writers who I follow closely are people who have a body of work that you can reference, that you can take a look at and see, hey, how right or wrong are these people historically? And none of the names I'm going to mention are anything people are going to be surprised at. They're pretty much a standard list. And I'll leave out people in my office, although Nick Majuli is a young guy. He's a data scientist and a quant. His stuff is always interesting. He writes once a week. And Ben Carlson could very well be the best financial writer that uses a lot of data to make his point that's out there. I laughed the other day. I saw somebody called us the Ritholtz Mafia. Cracked me up. Outside of the Ritholtz Mafia, Morgan Housel is just such a spectacular, not just writer, but thinker, and his perspectives and insights are just really, really great. Jason Zweig at the Wall Street Journal. I mean, Jason is probably the gold standard by which anybody else who is writing about finance is judged. I've been a giant fan of Dan Gross. He used to write for Slate, and I'm trying to remember the name of the entity where he writes from. I just get an email whenever he pops out something new. His stuff is always so interesting. Jesse Eisinger, ProPublica. And there's probably another 100 people behind that I know I could rely on their assessment for being sober and thoughtful. And Annie Duke calls the process of looking at outcomes over process resulting. That's a poker player phrase. You want people who are not outcome focused. You want them to be process focused, because so many outcomes are just a probabilistic bet. If the weatherman says 75% chance of rain tomorrow and it doesn't rain, it doesn't mean he was wrong. It means the 25% probability came up. And so we need to look for people when we're reading who understand probabilities and statistics, who are not enumerate. There are a shocking number of financial writers who just can't do basic math. A quick funny story during the financial crisis. My mom was a real estate agent, which is why I tracked housing so closely, because it was dinner conversation growing up. And it was clear something funky was going on between the no-doc mortgages and the 228 adjustables. And there's a whole run of crazy stuff that was happening. And anyway, it was still early in the collapse of real estate, like 07. And the Wall Street Journal had a piece out that said, housing seems to be improving because look at the sales data for April. It's better than March and February. And I write this polite email to the editor and the writer saying, hey, you guys are aware that housing is seasonal, right? Because anybody with kids wants to get in the new school district before September, before the new school year. So there's a tendency for, and plus spring in places where there's a winter, there's a tendency for the selling season to really kick off March or April, where things are starting to get nice and houses present the best. You'll get a better price with a house with a full garden and nice lawn than you will with one covered in ice and snow. And so December, January is the low point of the year. It improves a little bit in February, and then in March, and then in April, and ultimately it peaks around June, July, and August, and then starts heading back down to December. So when you're telling me April is better than March and March is better than February, that's like saying, oh my God, what happened to retail sales in January? They fell off a cliff. No, there's some post-Christmas seasonality there. Housing is the exact same thing. And so instead of erroneously looking at it month over month, why don't you look at it year over year? How is March 07 compared to March 06 compared to March 05? And when you do that, you see a giant decrease in volume and a giant decrease in prices. And that went on for years and years and years. And I showed that chart every year for, I want to say 5 years. And it was infuriating that the Wall Street Journal just refused to acknowledge, A, they made a mistake, and B, they have a tendency, like so many other media outlets, to throw the youngest, greenest person on. You do the boring economic stuff. Nobody else wants to do that. And so somebody who just has no experience and doesn't know better says, oh, look, housing improved from March to April. No, it always improves from March to April, unless there's a coronavirus lockdown, in which case housing will fall off the cliff. And so this is the outlier year.
I think the big goal, and they've accomplished this with their board of directors now being at least half women on the board, women in investing. We recently had Lizanne Saunders on our show, a guest of one of your prior shows as well. In the first 7 minutes, we talked about the beginning of her career and women in investing. And I wanted to congratulate you on hiring Blair, who is well regarded by the CFA Institute and was previously on their conference committee. And Lizanne talked about making sure that your firm looks like the client base you're trying to serve, which is in general, half the population is female, half is male. I know Rick Edelman mentioned at several conferences I attended that women are not a niche for a client base since they are half the population. Any thoughts on serving women as a client base? Or do you sort of take the Rick Edelman stance that they're not a niche because they are half the population?
It's a little bit of both. He's right. They're 50% of the population. We're really on just the early edge of a $31 trillion generational wealth transfer. And the way that typically has progressed in the past is there's a tendency for women to outlive men, to wives to outlive their husband. And so what'll happen is a lot of this $31 trillion will end up in the hands of the spouses before it eventually makes its way down, spouses exclusively, once the husband shuffles off this mortal coil, before it ends up in the next generation or in philanthropy or wherever it ends up going. So it's not a niche, but there's a really specific, unique trend. And we were very conscious when we launched, or a little afterwards, that, hey, we're four white dudes from Long Island. I mean, really, let's see if we can not become a stereotype. And to hire women in finance is a giant challenge, not because of sexism in 2020, but because they're incredibly valuable unicorns to where they are. We've made a ton of offers to various women at Morgan Stanley and UBS and Merrill Lynch, and they basically say, well, I have to at least give my firm a chance to match that offer. And they end up staying where they are because they get a spectacular offer along with some additional accolades and responsibilities, because for the exact reason you're talking about with a publicly traded company, they want to show women in senior positions. To their credit, when we look at Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley, look at people like Ellen Zentner at Morgan Stanley, their chief economist, or Constant Hunter, who is, I think she is at KPMG, or Michelle Meyer at Merrill Lynch. Go down the list. The past decade has seen a huge change in women at senior positions. And it predates me, but go back to the 1980s and some of the sexual harassment suits and the boom boom rooms and all that crazy stuff that led to a series of consent decrees. In some ways, the street was way behind the rest of society, but in other ways, they kind of had their Me Too moments a little earlier than other sectors did. And so it's been a very mixed bag, but it clearly has changed dramatically for the better over the past 30 years. So we've started to get a little better at figuring out how can we attract women to join the firm. And we have a number of women who are either CFPs or CFAs working for the firm. We're always looking to add more. And there are all sorts, as you guys know, at the CFA, there are all sorts of different specializations you can do. We've had conversations with women whose core focus is divorce, and that's their specialty, is working, because very often the current situation is a woman's in her 40s, 50s, 60s, the husband has handled the finances, their whole marriage, they get divorced, and suddenly she's got a chunk of money, some income coming in, and a good part of either a pension or a 401k that it was never her responsibility to manage before. And now she suddenly says, hey, I need some help. When people refer to certain niches, that might be what they are thinking about. I think somebody, especially if it's an unpleasant divorce, maybe they aren't looking for a male advisor who is not going to be the most respectful of them. Maybe a female advisor is a better fit under those circumstances. It obviously changes person to person. It's obviously a question of individual preferences, but that is certainly the sort of niche that some people might be referring to.
And Barry, looking at the future of our industry, this summer we have Forum CRS coming out. And I think a lot of the firms with dings on their record are going to be disproportionately impacted by this. Any thoughts on Form CRS, the two-page document that's going to be required in July from RIAs, and how it will impact firms?
I don't know how that's going to play out. There was a giant Wall Street Journal article, I want to say it was about a year ago, about both RIAs and brokerage firms who had either brokers or advisors that had all these dings on their record, which the firm was not disclosing, not revealing. So I think the more transparency there is, the better off everybody will be. On the other hand, you have to find a balance between someone who early in their career didn't fully understand some of the technicals of the rules and might have made just a technical error, not an actual egregious problem. I don't know how you balance that. That's really the challenge in implementing those sorts of things.
And then what the CFP board did recently, and I'm not sure if you saw that, and I know Jason Zweig, I'm a big fan of his as well, he sort of railed on this, the fee only, fee and commission, or commission only. Those were the three things that I would check as a CFP practitioner. And then they got rid of it recently. And they said, hey, you should have a conversation with your advisor to see how they bill. With a salesperson, they're asking you to go have a conversation instead of knowing how they bill in advance of that conversation. Do you have any thoughts about that decision that the CFP board made recently?
I think they shanked it. I think they really made a mistake. What could be simpler than saying, how do you get paid? Am I the only priority? Are you truly a fiduciary? Or do you have wholesalers and mutual funds and others paying you to either take shelf space or have you push a product? Look, we were talking about cars before. When I go to a used car dealer, I know he wants to get a maximum amount of dollars from me and sell whatever he has on the lot. He doesn't care about what I need, what I want, what's a good fit for me. If car dealers were fiduciaries, imagine that conversation. Hey, who are you? What do you need? What's your cost structure? What do you make? How much can you afford? What other debt do you have? It becomes a very different conversation. And then that automobile consultant goes out and says, I think the best car for you isn't this Ferrari, but you need a nice Honda Accord without leather or all the fancy trims. It's $24,000. This is right in your sweet spot. Just picture, think about if car sellers were fiduciaries. Anything we do to make financial advisors, consultants, CFPs, brokers, et cetera, closer on the spectrum to the used car dealer than your doctor, lawyer, or accountant does not help the investor. It helps the industry. And I would rather see the investor get the full benefit of a full fiduciary, including transparency on fees and no conflict of interest. A conversation as opposed to a transparent disclosure means that there has to be some inherent conflict of interest. Otherwise, you would just disclose, we are fee only. You are our highest priority. We do not compromise the service we offer to you in any way, shape, or form because our job is to do what's best for you, full stop.
And speaking of fiduciaries that use TD Ameritrade and Charles Schwab, and I believe those are the two custodians you use. The merger, do you believe it still will go through despite COVID? And then assuming it does, will this help or hurt advisory firms and indirectly help or hurt investors?
I haven't read or heard anything as to why COVID might have this not go through. It would make my life easier because we want to have two custodians. We want to have a compare and contrast. We've had clients ask us before the takeover, I don't care where I custody, who do you like better, TD or Schwab? And our answer is always the same. They're both really, really good institutions. They will both do a really good job, but gun to the head on just about every cost, TD is cheaper than Schwab. Why is that? Because Schwab is giant and they have all their own proprietary products. And they're beloved. We added Schwab because we had an endless number of clients who have, or prospective clients who said, I would love for you to be my advisor, but I'm loyal to Schwab. I want to keep my money at Schwab. So eventually, after you hear that enough times, it's like, hey, we better add Schwab because people want Schwab. They're two different institutions. And I don't know how they're going to manage this merger. This is going to be, they have a lot of work ahead of them. I'm sure they've been really busy since the merger was announced, figuring out how they're going to integrate two very different companies. My assumption is for firms like our size or larger, they're going to add a third or fourth custodian, or in this case, once the merger's through, a second or third custodian. And I imagine a lot of people are looking at places like Fidelity as a custodian or Pershing Bank of New York as a custodian or any of the other larger custodians, because you want to give your clients choice and you, of course, want to have options. You never want to be overly dependent on any one service provider in case you run into an issue with them. Having flexibility is a huge thing. I don't know what it's going to mean for advisors. We've been hearing that solo practitioners are going to be pressured for years and years and years. TD was very welcoming to us when we first launched. They were originally our sole custodian before we added Schwab. I think the landscape is going to change and it might become a little more challenging or a little more costly if you're a solo practitioner with $50 or $100 million. The economies of scale aren't there until you're $300, $400, $500 million. So it'll be interesting to see the way this plays out. And I have no idea what happens. I have no insight or special knowledge as to which way this is going to go. The only thing I could say is it's good to have options. And now there will be one less option once the integration is done.
I agree with everything you said. I think Schwab did a good job hiring Tom Bradley.
One last question before we get to our end episode question. So you've talked about how some people on your staff have the CFA, some have the CFP. You've got data scientists on staff. You've got other people who are great writers. Talk about the certain skill set you think younger people coming up in the business need to work on having these days and what they should be prioritizing.
What I would do if I could go back in time is two things. I have some probability and statistical classes, but I would have emphasized more of that. I would have more stats and more probabilities. And I'm pretty good with HTML and some other coding, but I would really want to learn to code in a very aggressive way. If you look at certain people, Len Kiefer is the chief economist. I think he's at Freddie Mac, or Torsten Slack at Deutsche Bank. These are folks who really know their way around data. They really know their way around not just Excel, but genuine coding. So not only can they do the probability analysis, but they can cobble together a program that allows them to generate certain types of output from data that normally you need a third party to do that. So I think that's really important. I used to say to people, become aware of behavioral finance and understand how your own behavior and how your own cognitive functions affect your decision making. But I think at this point, that's a given, isn't it? I mean, when I first went down that rabbit hole in the early to mid 90s with Thomas Gilovich's How We Know It Isn't So, I mean, that was very early. I mean, that was my inspiration moment. And my career probably would be nowhere if it wasn't for not only finding that book, and the first half of it just was mind-blowing at the time, in the mid-90s. If you weren't a clinical psychologist reading Kahneman and Tversky, none of this stuff was out there. I want to say this was the first popular mainstream book about behavioral finance, and it just was a game changer. I think that's now the cost of admission. I think you have to understand the basics of behavioral economics or you can't play.
I think those are all good points. And as we wrap up, we appreciate your time today. Where can people learn more about you and your firm?
So RitholtzWealth.com is where our website is, although we really don't really think of the corporate website as anything more than just a place for people to actually find out how to reach either us or an advisor or something like that. I and all my crew at the bottom of that site, there's a list of all our blogs. I blog at The Big Picture, which is Ritholtz.com. The Reform Broker is Josh Brown. The Irrelevant Investor is Mike Batnick's humble name for his blog. A Wealth of Common Sense is Ben Carlson. The Bell Curve is Blair Duquesne. And Of Dollars and Data is Nick Majuli. And then Last is a teachable moment is Tony Isola. And I'm trying to remember what Dina Isola's blog is. But you can find us on social media and pretty much everywhere else. Josh is on CNBC a few times a week. I'm on Bloomberg a couple of times a week. I mean, if you want to find us, we're not too difficult to find. We're harder to avoid than we are to find.
Touche. It's a fair statement. Couple of end of episode questions for you. So first, if there was one person in the world right now you could have a conversation or interview with, who would it be? And obviously, you've had a lot of on Masters in Business, so I'm interested to hear your answer.
The white whale that I have left is Jim Simons, who is notoriously reclusive, although he gave Greg Zuckerman about 10 hours because Zuckerman's basically said, hey, the book is coming out and people are talking about you. Do you want to define how people see you? Or do you want to let other people define how people see you? And by the way, I, undergraduate at Stony Brook, I began my career as applied mathematics and physics. The outgoing math chairman was Jim Simons, who I've never had a conversation with, but saw him. And the funny thing is, if you met him back then, you would never have given him a dime. I mean, he was a chain-smoking, scruffy bearded, like academic that under no circumstances would you have thought, oh yeah, I want to give my money to that guy. But I would love to have a conversation with Simons. He would be fascinating. Next after him would probably be Jamie Dimon. He's another fascinating guy, and I would love to have a conversation with him. There's a longer list, but those two are pretty much the top white whales I have.
Sounds like you just need to write a sequel to Zuckerman's book on Jim Simons in a couple of years and then corner him on that.
I got to leave that to Greg. By the way, that book is just a I don't do book reviews. I think I've done one twice in the past 10 years, other than a list, go read these 10 books. But that was one of the books I had to write about, The Man Who Solved the Markets, because it was just astonishing.
It's on my list to read after listening to your podcast with Zuckerman. And the last question, what are you most optimistic and pessimistic about in the world right now?
I'm kind of pessimistic. So in 2 weeks, not this weekend, by the time this comes out, the upcoming podcast will be Jim Chanos. And Chanos made this really interesting point about politics. And his point was, go look through the history of U.S. elections, landslides. People who lose the presidency in a landslide, they get about 40% of the vote. And that it's strictly my guy over the other guy, even if my guy's an idiot. I'm still going to vote for my guy. And I'm a little pessimistic about the tribalism and how the internet has enabled a lot of things that used to really have no resonance to generate resonance. Before there was World Wide Web, every town had a crackpot. Every town had a crank hanging in the library researching how the Illuminati are controlling their mind and why you need aluminum foil to protect their brain controlling waves. And those people were all nuts. But once you get the internet and connect all of them, instead of 50,000 small towns, each with their own nut, you get a movement, and suddenly it becomes self-reinforcing. And so you get, forget anti-vaxxers. That's one group of idiots. You get, and global warming denials. There's literally thousands of people who claim to believe, and I still can't believe it. So that's why I say claim to believe, that the earth is flat. But there's one less of those
because he tried to
launch himself up in a rocket to prove it. And apparently he was unfamiliar with how gravity worked, and unfortunately he perished in that experiment. But really, if you don't believe in science and you don't believe in technology, well, please don't use any of the things that's, don't get in an elevator, don't use a cell phone, don't drive a car. If you want to be Amish, and I have nothing against the Amish, but if you don't believe in science, stop using the benefits of science and technology. So that's what I'm most pessimistic about. The fact that a huge swath of humans spend a good portion of their day trying to prove that Darwin was right and exit themselves from the gene pool. And that's something to be pessimistic about. The flip side of that, the optimistic side about that, is the continual ingenuity and innovation of humanity. And I said this on an interview about a month ago and people were a little aghast, but I'll repeat it. there will eventually be some form of treatment for the coronavirus. There will eventually be a vaccine. There'll be a protocol. There'll be something that will allow life to return to normal. Why do I say that? Because we came up with solutions to measles and smallpox and rubella and tuberculosis and go down the list of diseases that human ingenuity has cured. There's no reason to think that this one is going to be any different. And making the bet against the ingenuity of humanity has been a losing bet for millennia. We always seem to find a way to improve our situation, increase our standard of living, make the world a little better. If you read people like Hans Rosling, if you read the folks or Steven Pinker, the world has been getting better on a continuous basis. Yes, you can point out to things that are terrible. You can point out to, look at the Dark Ages, at least in the Western world, things didn't get better for 700 years. It was getting better in the Far East and the Middle East, but Europe had a long period where there were no improvements. But again, those are the outliers that prove the point. The default setting for humanity is continual improvement of our conditions and standard of living and quality of life. And hopefully we don't destroy ourselves in the process. I'm confident that we will think our way through the challenges that face us.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Barry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me. It's interesting being on the other side of the Q&A instead of being the one who has to think about the questions. So thanks for having me.
No, I appreciate it. For those interested in similar investing podcasts, check out the CFA Institute's podcast called Take 15, which features quick conversations with some of the top minds in the world. Also check out CFA New York's podcast called Compound Insights and CFA Chicago's podcast called CFA Society Chicago.
You've been listening to the Investors First Podcast, a service of CFA Society Orlando. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also learn more about each episode and the society itself at cfasociety.org/Orlando/podcast. Thank you, and we'll see you next time on the Investors First Podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinion of their firm. This podcast is not intended to provide expert advice on topics covered and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. If you need tax, accounting, or legal advice, please consult a professional.